the Monsters of Television podcast. I'm Nick Campbell.
I'm Matt Owens.
And then we also have Noel Kirkpatrick.
Hello.
And then Karen Petrusco.
Hello.
And we are the Monsters of Television. And we're going to talk about some of the TV shows that we watched this week, including Walking Dead, House, some stuff that's happened in CW lately, and some other exciting things that have been going on. Hopefully you'll enjoy it. If not, I don't know what to tell you. I guess, you know, I kind of want, in order to start everything off, let's kind of start off with stuff from the beginning of the week. You guys want to talk about Walking Dead real quick?
Yeah, why did everyone hate it so much? I liked it.
I liked it too, so.
I didn't hate it. Now, hate's a strong word. I was just a little disappointed by it. I think that the pilot promised me or something, and it didn't end up giving me what the pilot promised.
Oh, good. Okay, so what did the pilot promise you?
Pilot promised me a little more depth and character. It promised me a little less of a... I mean, it still had the horror tropes in it, but it didn't have, like, the gimmicky, shallow stuff that the second episode had. Like, introducing all those random characters. And I understand that it's kind of an action... It's more of an action-focused episode. Mm-hmm. But there's time in those little moments throughout the episode that they could have given me a little more of that character depth than they gave me in the first episode.
So you want quieter moments to allow us to actually get to know these people, but...
I don't think that's too much to ask, I don't think.
I don't think it's too much to ask.
I don't think it's too much to ask either, but I mean, look at it. I mean, AMC just canceled Rubicon, and that's nothing but quiet character moments. So...
Do you think they're scared of that now? Do you think now all of a sudden we're going to get this amped up, awesome zombie apocalypse adventure because they're afraid to have actual character development?
No, I don't think that's true at all, because I don't think that they were going to... I don't think they knew that they were going to cancel Rubicon when they filmed the second episode of Walking Dead.
Well, how many episodes are there of Walking Dead?
13.
Six for this season.
Six, really? That's what I thought. We're only going to get a few right out, right? So they're trying to do an awful lot in six episodes, which means get us all the basic characters, get them all into place so that we can have the man see his wife and all that kind of good stuff. That's all going to happen really fast. So it kind of seems like there is a burden of action up front, in part because they're only getting a short run.
I thought they already picked up a second season, too, though.
Well, they did. They already picked up a second season. But when they created the program, how much did they know they were going to have? What were their goals within those first six? They probably wanted to come out kicking. And so action is usually the best way to do that.
But the first episode seemed more like an AMC-branded kind of episode. And the second episode seemed more, I don't know, just a way broader than what I would have hoped for.
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, it's only been two episodes. So, sure. And the thing is, you know, television today does respond to the Twitterverse and other, you know, fan reactions. So the show will definitely take some time to find its sea legs. But I guess the expectations that the first one set up, that's what I was surprised by. You have made it pretty clear that you really felt that first episode led you in a particular direction. I guess I didn't take it that way. I kind of just said, I'm along for the ride to see where this goes. And I'm just going to kind of take the first few episodes and then evaluate.
Well, that's my problem in general, really, is that I feel that, I mean, look at Chuck. Like, Chuck should be not anything to anybody, but you know, I have such high expectations for that show, and that's why I'm constantly disappointed. Really, I set myself up for disaster every week.
Well, I'm not against high expectations, and I think the good thing is you're very clear about what you want it to be, or what you think it set up for you. But, I mean, as far as the second episode goes, Noel and I have talked about this. I mean, it was very tightly focused.
Yeah.
It gave us the new characters all in a real, you know, high pressure situation, so that we had a lot of intensity and a lot of drive. They had a very clear goal, which was get out of the building, mm-hmm. and they accomplished that by the end. So in terms of just like, you know, an hour of TV or what have you, I feel like it had a good beginning, middle, and end. The new characters, I don't know too much about them yet. I'm not really sure, except for the young kid. I'm not really sure who I particularly care about. We know that one of them is a sister, so we're supposed to care about her. So, yeah, I certainly haven't, like, latched on to those particular characters yet.
That was interesting, too, is that the characters Andrea and, I can't remember the
Glenn?
Name. Andrea. They gave us time to kind of explore Andrea. They gave us time to explore Glenn, but everybody else they kind of just push off to the side. And tangentially, the guy that Michael Rooke is playing, I'm so tired of seeing people in Atlanta being hicks and being racist hicks. Like, I mean, we all four of us have connections to Atlanta, and yep. Walking Dead, sadly, is kind of our ambassador from Atlanta right now, and I'm kind of tired of seeing the racist hick character coming out of Atlanta.
Well, I guess they need some sort of a human bad guy at some point, and a racist is certainly an easy one to go after.
Well, especially with the zombie narrative, I mean, race always gets tied into the zombie narrative, so I feel like that's a pretty normal extension of what they're doing with Walking Dead by having that racial conversation up front like that.
And I suppose my main concern with, Twitter is certainly kind of altering how I view television, because I'm always behind in watching everything, so I get the reaction first and then go in, so it does alter how I view, but I think it was the degree of disappointment that I thought was maybe a little bit off base. Like, we don't know enough yet to really be like, this is what this show is, and it has now violated its primary values. You know, we don't know enough yet. And it just, from the high of the first week to the low, I feel like we're all kind of needing a little bit of medication to help us deal with kind of TV when everybody's immediately got an opinion.
The disappointment did sink a little bit low. I mean, just because the second episode didn't maybe live up to the first one, if for those of us that really believed in the first episode, it shouldn't be a deal breaker. Like, it's just a second episode.
Yeah, and I just think that sometimes the echo chamber of the internet intensifies some of our reactions in a way that I don't know if it's always helpful for viewers and helpful for showrunners.
Sure. Right.
But that said, I'm actually interested to see where it goes. I think the main character is interesting. I think the fact that he already had so many issues with his wife means that there could be some great character stuff that goes on there, depending on the direction they take it. But
I'm glad you bring up the wife, because, I mean, what's everyone's take on whether or not she was already having an affair with his partner?
I think she was already having an affair with his partner.
She was.
Yeah, that's how I read it, too. Okay, I wanted to make sure that we were all on that same page.
It's because of how he asked the partner, when they one of the opening scenes when the two men are in the car and they're kind of talking about their lives like men don't usually do. He's very interested in the relationship with the wife, and I just can't imagine that ever happening unless he had a stake in that conversation. Mm-hmm.
That's how I felt about it, too.
Totally. So, yeah, Walking Dead. Again, just to kind of reiterate, like, I don't feel like the second episode was bad, just not what I was expecting. A little disappointing, but I totally see your guys' point that it's they don't have a whole lot of time to really kind of really hook people in, and having that kind of action-packed episode where they kind of introduce all the characters, make sure that you are familiar with everybody. I think, yeah, it is probably the way to go. Just I was expecting something different. That's all.
Well, no, that's great. No, I'm sorry. Just, you know, I think that your point is very valid and should be taken. And I'm just doing a wait and see kind of approach right now.
Sure. That's no problem. Well, I kind of am too.
The other thing that we should think about is, I mean, they didn't have that huge of a drop in ratings from one episode to the second episode. But I'm curious if, based on the fact that the second episode was wall to wall zombie action, how people are going to, if they're actually going to see a slight uptake. As people went, oh my god, you guys missed all the zombie craziness, and then they go to the camp, and it's just like, there's no zombies in this show.
Well, this is the question, right? Who is the makeup of this particular audience? Is it right. The Mad Men group, or is it actually a much broader group that AMC is tapping into, which is going to kind of alter perhaps what AMC defines as their kind of show? You know, I don't know yet who all, their numbers are big, and their numbers are bigger than Mad Men big, right? I mean, it's not just
Mad Men, yeah.
It's not just, you know, those of us that are already committed to some AMC experimental television. They are getting those people who want that wall-to-wall action. And I suspect they're always going to have a bit of a tension between what they're trying to develop in this kind of slow-mo character-based model and trying to reach broader. So this might be a conversation we continue to have about this show.
Absolutely true. What they have with making a horror movie that's a horror series is that they are able to get that character development, so it makes it different from a horror movie, but then it's different from an AMC model in general because it's got that propensity for action. And, kind of like in that Breaking Bad kind of vein where, it's got that wide audience appeal too because it's got something that everybody can connect with and isn't just slow-moving, you know, Rubicon glacial storytelling.
Hey, don't kick me yet, okay?
We'll get there.
Well, it does seem Walking Dead naturally leads to the Rubicon conversation since everybody is blaming Walking Dead for Rubicon getting canceled, which is, I think, very interesting, that particular conversation. How dare Walking Dead be so different and popular?
How dare they? The nerve.
Damn really. Popular kids.
No, you want to talk about Rubicon a little bit and your the sadness that you feel, the mourning and loss?
I feel so much lost, as if I'm just waiting to find a four-leaf clover in my newspaper tomorrow. And it's just not going to be good. No, I mean, I understand how people are responding to Rubicon's cancellation as being Walking Dead's fault. I'm not entirely convinced that that's true. I mean, I'm with Jamie Wyman in that it was probably a double-edged sword, as in it could have really gone either way, that we could have nurtured this little show on our network based on our... We could have subsidized, basically, Rubicon based on Walking Dead's success. But I just don't think that was the case. I think, even though I really loved the finale, I think that a lot of people were just so frustrated by how deflating the finale was that they just went, maybe no one's going to come back for this based on that finale. And, I mean, that last scene is just like... And it just goes away. I mean, Truxton tells them that this will keep going. And then it just goes away. I mean, then we get to the preview of Mad Men starting in 60 seconds. It's just like, what?
But you know what the finale reaction reminded me of? If I can go a little old school here. Twin Peaks. The issue with Twin Peaks, I think it was on multiple levels. But, I mean, obviously the show was weird. But people really wanted to find out who killed Laura Palmer. And they wanted to find out by the end of season one. Like, when you set up a narrative that is largely driven by one big mystery, even if you have other subplots that are equally engaging, what have you, people want to get some sort of answer by the end of season one. And that Rubicon kind of fell into that same kind of trap, I think, that just finding out that the bad guy we already knew was a bad guy was indeed a bad guy, that's not the reveal that we needed here. We needed something more. We needed him taken down in some way. I mean, a new white man can rise up. There's plenty of white men that could rise up, but... I think that's where they missed the mark, is that they needed to provide some sort of resolution. And they didn't do it.
Well, I don't know. I'll drive this point into the ground as much as I can. I just don't feel like there needed to be that kind of resolution, because it just didn't fit with the genre that they were drawing so heavily from, which is that whole 1970s paranoid thriller, where, I mean, you can't win. That's the entire point of those big overarching conspiracies, is that even if you take down Truxton Spangler, there's still the four other guys in that massively large room with the horrible lighting that are still going to be controlling things, and you can only do so much with it. And I think that's what frustrated people, was the kind of pessimism at the end of the show that just drove it home, I think. That they weren't happy with the pessimism of it all.
Well, we could take it to a deeper level and say, can television do that kind of 70s type show, paranoid fantasy? Because when it's a long form narrative and you're along for the ride for that type of commitment, I mean, this isn't 2 hours, you're in and you go crazy and then you're out. This is kind of an intense engagement with that kind of paranoia. And the truth is, I think that there needs to be some ups and downs, and there need to be some, you know, level peaks that happen. And I just don't think, I'm not saying television can't do it. I'm just saying, I think the writers for Rubicon failed to understand a fundamental need of television, especially if you're going to come back for season two and commit again on a weekly basis to something where you know you aren't going to get a ton of answers, but you're really there for something else. You're really there for the character stuff. And I'd say even on a character level, the conversation with Spangler at the end was not satisfying. Will did not get enough relief from that.
You know what show this conversation reminds me a lot of?
What's that?
Sounds a lot like Lost.
What a shock. Matt, you think everything sounds like Lost.
No, but I mean, I'm serious. Think about it. It's this, you've got all of these grand mysteries. Some are solved, some aren't. For some people, it was worth it to come back only for the characters. Some people didn't think that that was enough. So what is the difference there? I mean, yes, Rubicon and Lost are very different genres. Rubicon wasn't, like, sci-fi at all, like Lost had elements. But what is the difference? What could Rubicon have done similar to, if you want to call Lost a success, because not everyone necessarily does for some odd reason, but what is the difference? How do you balance answering questions and not answering questions and pissing off your audience to such an extreme extent?
But it's the finale. conceit that's the issue, and that's why I'm talking about actual, what does television do, and what is its structure? And its structure depends upon, at the end of every season, you have something that gives you some sort of peace, but also it gets you intrigued for the next season. And this is just an element, the nature of how television is set up. If we had TV shows that went throughout the year and just took little mini breaks, we'd actually think of them very differently. Yeah. Rubicon probably would do better with that kind of model than with this model where, you know, the seasons of Lost that seem to have done, that have been received most highly, generally ended with some sort of a bang by the end of that season. With shows that have mystery, there just seems to be a lot of pressure. I'm not saying there should be. I'm just saying that seems to be what the reaction is based on.
Yeah.
It's true, especially with AMC having their giant hiatuses between shows. I mean, cable in general generally has that too, where they have not just... I mean, with broadcast, it's only like 3 or 4 months, but with AMC, it seems like... I mean, Breaking Bad's not coming back to what, next year? And it ended in the spring. I mean, in order to have, kind of keep that momentum going, you have to have something where you have that kind of... that cliffhanger at the end of the season, while also keeping in that piece that you give to the audience too. So it's got to be strong, I mean even stronger for the AMC thing in order to keep the momentum going.
But so then in keeping with AMC, the Mad Men finale, as good as it was, there was no real big, I didn't have a, oh my god, what's going to happen next season as much as I did at the end of season 3. At the end of season 3, you've got, oh man, the formation of this new company, how is this going to go over? Sure, we've got Don and this ridiculously, terribly thought out marriage proposal to Megan, and you know,
like
as
it.
I'm interested to see where that's going to go, it's not, you know,
exactly.
I can
go, Matt, it's going to go, Don's going to go right back to where he was always before that. It's how all the seasons go.
Okay, so then that even, I mean, that helps the point I'm making even better then. It's like, okay, we know what's going to happen with that. It's going to go bad because it's Don Draper related. So what that, there's no big cliffhanger that makes me have to watch the next season of Mad Men, other than the fact that I really like Mad Men.
I think I respond differently to the marriage than other people do, because to some extent you could say Don has realized that his life at home can just be one little part of his life, that coming home to the empty apartment was misery and he hated it, and that having someone at home who seems to be relatively accepting of him but doesn't have the intensity of Betty might be just enough, and his work is what's going to drive him. I mean, he still has to build a company. He still has, you know, all kinds of demons that are still haunting him. But, you know, part of that, the marriage to me just kind of was an acknowledgement on his end that, you know what, he wasn't really capable of dealing with a woman who could meet him on his own terms or challenge him in her own way, and that he chose to go with the easier route. And, you know, I suspect he will continue to cheat and do all the things that he has typically done. He might have chosen work, like Peggy did. He chose work. He got married, but that was a choice for work.
I think that, I agree with you, but I also think that it's also just a cycle for him. Like, you know, yeah, he got divorced from Betty, and he was his own man for a little bit. But essentially, he's marrying Betty again. And
you think so? I don't
know.
No,
he's not. That's the point. He's not marrying Betty again at all.
Thank you.
If for no other reason than that scene in the diner with the spilled milkshake, and she's
yes.
like, oh, it's not a big deal. We'll just clean it up. And all of them, Don and the kids, they're all like, what the hell is going on? Why is no one yelling at me? Why is this not a big deal?
Yes.
That is the only thing that you need to know that separates Megan from Betty.
Do you think that Betty was the same way when she first started out, when her and Don were starting to date?
No, I don't think she was. I think she was always disappointed, because Betty never... Betty always wanted more, and life wasn't there to offer her more. There just isn't the possibilities within the... I mean, I actually think Betty could have been an interesting person if she'd born in any other time period and hadn't been, you know, trained the way she had been. I think Megan's much more content in that role. So, yeah, I agree that... you could also look at it as the marriage was Don's first real great act of being a father ever in the series. Yeah.
I don't know, those Beatles tickets, that was pretty awesome.
This is true. But I mean, Megan is someone who might actually give those kids a chance, you know? Yeah.
I don't know if I want to see a well-adjusted Sally Draper, though.
This is true. Don't worry, she's becoming a teenager. There'll be plenty of angst.
Oh, I can't wait for Sally angst.
Yeah, who knew that character became so much less annoying this year? I was just shocked and amazed by how she was actually interesting.
Yeah.
Miracle of miracles.
Sally was interesting in the season before, though. I mean, I mainlined all of it, but I found Sally really interesting in season three too.
So, I don't know. Baby's throwing temper tantrums a lot. It's really hard to derive enough dramatic weight from that. You kind of just want him to shut up.
So children should be seen and not heard.
Yeah, okay, call me Betty Draper. You know, we'll see what happens. But having Sally actually be a more complex character, I guess that's what they did for her
right. This
season. I really feel like they gave her her own subplots. She had her own secret life that she was trying to keep from her mother. She had a whole host of things that she was discovering on her own. That worked for me.
Well, Glenn is someone who should always keep someone, so...
So we'll see what happens, but the jury's, I think, is still out on what AMC is working towards.
And they've got two more shows coming down the pipeline.
Do you know what they are?
One's a remake of a Danish show called The Killing.
Mm.
I forget what the other show that they have coming down is, or The Killers, or something like that.
So we'll have to see. And, I mean, ultimately, you do also have to ask of your television... where is the balance between the artistic venture and the commercial mandate? And Rubicon didn't have the numbers. Lone Star didn't have the numbers. Sometimes, and there's all kinds of reasons shows don't get the audience that they may deserve. And that those, I'd rather have that conversation about what could they have done differently, how could they have sold it differently, or this kind of thing, than necessarily going to, it's The Walking Dead's fault, but
yeah,
I might be more optimistic.
Well, do you think that, Lone Star was on broadcast and didn't do well at all. We've kind of looked at cable being that place where niche television shows have a place that they can thrive and, like, you know, storytelling can push boundaries and stuff like that.
Based on what evidence?
Well, not recently, obviously. I mean, Mad Men is still going on, and that I'm not sure if Mad Men would be able to continue if it were on broadcast, especially with the things that it's done.
But Rome got two seasons, right? Rome only got two. Rome was actually a pretty impressive show if you could stick with it. All those HBO shows, I have such a hard time with them because you have to wait till... See, they hit finales well. HBO always does those finales brilliantly. But the rest of the season, snail's pace. I have such a hard time with their shows. But they always bring it home in the end. Mm-hmm. But they get rid of shows when they feel like they don't have enough people or it's not doing whatever it is that they need an HBO show to do. I just wonder sometimes where this expectation comes from, that cable is the place that's going to save all of our TV.
They did it themselves. It was in marketing. Yeah. For so long, premium channels and cable channels were like, we are different. This is more than television. This is better than what...
So why aren't you buying it? Have they shown... That's what I'm saying. Just show me... Give me the examples, and they might be there, of the shows that really were kind of dead in the water kind of when they first appeared, and yet cable stuck with them, it nurtured them, it gave them the opportunity to thrive. You know? I'm not sure it's there.
I mean, do you think Friday Night Lights counts with DirecTV picking them up?
I think Friday Night Lights is a miracle.
I mean, Battlestar Galactica is another kind of niche program that went on for, you know, 4.5 seasons, and
but
that wouldn't have survived anywhere else.
Yeah. I think the niche element can save some shows because if they have enough passionate niche audience, but I mean, what's the niche for Rubicon?
Right. I mean, there aren't any 1970s paranoid thriller fans out there that want to watch long-form television. They're too busy being worried about their tinfoil hats.
I mean, they put it after Mad Men, so they wanted those of us watching Mad Men to stick around for that, and I'm not sure that Rubicon talked to the same audience.
No. I would say with the exception of Caprica, I would say look at some of Sci-Fi's programming. Look at Eureka and Warehouse 13. Very niche. They don't really put up that big of numbers, but Sci-Fi has trust in those shows because Warehouse 13 was very on the bubble for a long time on whether they were going to get picked up for a third season, which it eventually did. And Eureka had also been nurtured by them for so long, and they're going into, I think, their fifth season?
Yeah, you're right. That's pretty impressive, too. Eureka
those
got...
two programs are... It's impressive that Sci-Fi has kept those two around, because it's not like they're ratings monsters or anything.
I don't think it's, like, super impressive. I think it's more that they see shows like Warehouse 13 and Eureka being broad niche, basically. I mean, these are appealable sci-fi science fiction-based shows that aren't as... They aren't people in spaceships, which is always... That feels too science fiction-y.
Yeah.
Less general for a more general audience. I think you could show someone an episode of Warehouse 13 and they can go, oh, okay, so it's just a big adventure show a week type of thing. It's Hercules, but with artifacts from the Victorian era. Mm. So I think that they hang on to it because it's a broader appeal to science fiction than, say, Battlestar Galactica or something like Caprica, which is probably why they're going to Blood and Chrome or whatever the new Battlestar Galactica backdoor pilot movie is, with the adventures of young Bill Adama, basically.
Hmm. Well, there is an ongoing narrative of how these cable networks are branding their programming. So what Noel's talking about with the sci-fi, I mean, that's, yes, they're trying to be what they have been, keep that audience happy, and yet get to a broader audience, hence the name change and whatever else.
And so, why they bring WWE Raw over to sci-fi?
That's true.
Indeed.
We also have shows that are like on USA, like Psych, that's been on for, I mean, it's in the middle of its fifth season. We have Monk goes on for forever and ever. And I don't know that those are niche shows either, but those are more episodic shows and serialized shows. Do you feel like that serialization sometimes kills shows that are on networks like Terriers or like, trying to think of other shows that serialization...
Damages?
Yeah,
Damages.
Do you think that the serialization of those kind of shows, and USA constantly gets better ratings all the time, like over the spring and summer, USA just basically rocked for like 30 weeks straight. I mean, I think the only show that was beating White Collar and Psych for a while was iCarly.
Do you guys watch those shows?
iCarly?
What, iCarly?
Yeah.
No, the USA shows.
Oh, yeah. I do. I watch.
So what's the appeal?
The appeal, I think, is very episodic. It's got small arcs, so you don't really have to keep track of it. I think it's just that beach reading kind of appeal. They've got funny characters, and they've got very appealing characters. With storylines that anybody can follow, it's very broad in some instances, especially for something like Psych. I mean, it's essentially the premise for Psych is a kid pretends that he's psychic, hilarity ensues. I mean, it's not really a big premise to fall into, and especially for USA's, I feel like that's USA's brand. It's not, unlike AMC or FX, it's trying to be kind of a destination place. USA's just trying to be the place that you kind of flip into all the time. I mean,
they don't make you think too hard, USA.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, their shows are House or Law and Order or Psych or White Collar, just things that you are flipping through. It's like, oh, Psych's on, and you watch, and you can jump into any one of Psych. I mean, you can pretty much, except for the way the characters age over the last 5 years, and whether or not Sean is trying to date Juliet, I think that you can pretty much jump into any season of Psych, and you would be fine. And I think that that's kind of what they are looking at. That's their kind of brand, is that they're afraid of serialization. I think Ted at USA actually mentioned that earlier this weekend when he was doing his question and answer session, was that they're kind of afraid of serialization because they like that kind of popcorn feel to the brand, where you can just kind of jump in any time during the day and you can find something that you want to watch.
Are you worried that AMC is going to go that direction?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think that they're really kind of concentrating on that...
quality.
That quality, that destination kind of brand that they want to be a place that you go to. Like when you're thinking of, like, you want to watch something, you go to AMC because you watch their quality programming. But I think that because of that, it's going to end up that a lot of shows that might be really good storytelling or might have might be really slow, and that AMC brand might die off because of serialization. It's not going to be as successful as USA's been, especially the last two seasons.
Well, and I guess that's the other thing right there. You know, expectations, which has been kind of a theme here since our conversation started. What do we expect Walking Dead to be, and what is it turning out to be, et cetera? But what are the expectations AMC has? They were holding on to Rubicon for a while. They didn't make the decision until after Walking Dead started. I mean, I do think that there is some significance there. And, they do have to hit some basic numbers. So even if they're not trying to be USA, they still have to sell advertising. And maybe they found that they were going to have a harder time with Rubicon next season because, they weren't getting the numbers that they could actually sell those spots.
But, yeah, so Rubicon's dead. That's sad.
I don't know. It's...
Sorry, Noel.
I mentioned a little bit about USA and kind of popcorn entertainment, and I kind of mentioned briefly about House, so I'm going to make a terrible segue into talking about House. House this week had a breakthrough moment, I feel, for the season. Newell and I talked about this earlier this week, but they actually did something where House actually looked like his old self, and I finally vindicated the season for me, because I've hated the season. Matt and I have talked about how I'm a Huddy hater, because mm-hmm. I am a Huddy hater, and House actually going behind Huddy's back, or Huddy, going behind Cuddy's back and doing something, no matter how small it was, like what House did this week with the switching the blood tests compared to the other atrocities that he's committed against his patients over the last few seasons, and behind Cuddy's back as well.
Or, a small thing is, that doesn't always kill a dictator. I mean, come on.
I mean, he did take a sick girl, pumped all of her blood out of her system, kept her cold so that she would almost die, and then pumped her blood back in so they can find something that didn't end up even being related to her disease. He's committed a lot worse, and so for him just to switch a blood test to give this guy that had Hep C Hep A, I mean, it seems like a small thing, but it finally started off the storyline that I was hoping that they'd start off from the very beginning, is that House is going to put himself before anything ever. He's going to always put himself in the puzzle before everything else.
Yeah, the puzzle.
And I felt like that finally that he was putting the puzzle before the relationship, and that he was violating that trust and that self sabotage I've been hoping for. I mean, I finally got it. So
it's starting too early. I didn't think that these kind of betrayals and complications were going to start in their relationship only like halfway through the season. I thought that it might have been successful for a little while. You know, things could have been okay. I should have known better.
It should have been around like episode two. They had the quasi bottle episode for the first episode where they're inside the bedroom, and then the second episode I could see I wanted more betrayal then, and I thought that they were going to do that. I thought they were going to be like, House and Cuddy are going to be a successful couple. All of a sudden, House changes his ways and is in love. And that really made me want to throw up all over the place.
I mean, you knew it was never going to last. No matter when the destruction came, you knew it wasn't going to last.
Yes, hope against hope. But, I didn't want it to last. Because that's not, I mean, happiness is almost antithetical to House's nature. Mm-hmm. It's just, I mean, the show is not good when he's happy. And, I'm not saying he needs to go back on the drugs, but the show was better when he was. And, I don't know. I'm happy for this little breakthrough, and I'm just going to take what I can get. And even though I still kind of hope that this is all a drug-induced hallucination, but I actually felt good about this episode of House this week, even though there had its problems, but I think that we're finally on a trajectory that I can appreciate.
How's Joan of Arcadia doing?
Joan of Arcadia, she did all right, I guess. Better than I thought.
Better than you thought. She's Amber Tamblyn.
Yeah,
she's dating.
She's amazing. Come on.
She was much better on General Hospital. I'll say that.
The character's interesting to an extent. I like the fact that she's very young. She's this like medical genius. But there are way too many similarities to Cameron from seasons 1 and 2. And I hated Cameron in the beginning of this show. And so she kind of feels like this really smart Cameron 2.0. And I really want them to try and find ways to differentiate her from Jennifer Morrison's character.
Well, is that going to be necessary? I mean, is Tamlin going to be on that long? I mean, Olivia Wilde's going to come back eventually.
She will, but even still, it's like, well, if she's going to be on for that long, why can't we have a different and interesting character? If you're going to have a replacement for, you know, half of a season or however long she's going to be here, why would you do it in the same vein of a character we've already had on the show?
What's her function in relation to House?
She's the moral character. She doesn't like lying to the patient. She doesn't want to do anything that doctors aren't supposed to do. She doesn't like to cross the line like House does. And so every time they were having conversations about lying and stuff, I was like, I've heard this conversation before in seasons 1 and 2 with Cameron.
I think the other layer that's to her is that she is a brilliant genius, you know, super brain. So I think that at some point she might be able to be a foil on an intellectual level with House. But never on that same manipulative level as that house is at.
Yeah, play that up. Play the genius up, because that was the whole reason that Cuddy hired her in the first place, is she said that this woman is going to be a medical star, and I want her in my hospital.
What's also interesting about her character being brought in this late into the series is that you kind of see how manipulative the entire cast has gotten over the course of the years. I mean, mm-hmm. when they first got in, when they were just, you know, the ducklings falling, House kind of played with them and was their puppet master a little bit. And now they're all kind of playing those games with each other. And so to bring her into it, it kind of almost emphasizes the fact that how far they've come, or how far they've fallen, whichever way you want to look at
yeah.
it, since the beginning of the season. So I like her character being there, and I think that she has some value being there. I am not nearly as big an Amber Tamblyn fan as others might be, but I feel that her acting can be a little contrived at times. But
did you watch The Unusuals? Did anyone else watch The Unusuals?
I did.
No.
I mean, it came on. No. I watched that.
Yeah, it did. So you had to watch it. The show was fit. She was probably the best part about that, in my opinion. Anyway, she was the best part about that show. She was fantastic for the 6 episodes that the show lasted.
It's on Netflix. You can watch it.
Oh, I do.
Oh,
I do.
Of course you do.
There are some actors that just they do TV, and they what they do just works well there. So when they pop up on all these different shows, I think it's just kind of fun to see their thing in a different context, you know?
Yeah.
Right. I think that's true. I mean, like Tamblyn, I think, is one of those people who works really well on television. Nathan Fillion obviously works magnificently on television. He was made for TV. And I think Scott Bakula also is one of those guys who just does great on television as well. And I think Men of a Certain Age, he's done really well, and clearly Quantum Leap, of course. But, I mean, I think those type of actors really pop on TV.
And lest we forget Lauren Graham.
Pete, I was going to say Peter Krause, too. It's just everything, you know.
Yeah, Lauren Graham. I wish I could watch that show. I just can't get on the bandwagon. I'm sorry. Yeah,
Parenthood or More Girls?
Parenthood.
Oh, okay. As long as it's not Gilmore Girls, I don't really have.
Oh no,
issue.
No, I was all over Gilmore Girls until the last season where I actually did stop watching, which is crazy for me. I never do that, but I did.
There are only a couple of really good episodes in the middle of season 7 for Gilmore Girls, so you didn't miss a whole lot. And the last episode was real treacly and real over sentimental for me.
I don't like when politics messes with my programming. So when you hire the showrunner that made the show distinctive, when you fire her, I stop watching. When you get rid of the love interest on Alias because he's broken up with the lead actress, I stop watching. I just don't. When outside stuff messes with my programming, I just stop messing with that programming.
It's very noble of you.
Thank you. I try.
Yeah.
Their personal lives do not mess with my characters.
Let's move on to a show. Another show this week that I think maybe only two of us watched this week, but Chuck also had a decent episode this week, which, again, surprising to me because I've hated this entire season of Chuck, too. But, I mean, as much as I love that show, I seem to hate every episode every week.
Ever since Chuck got his powers, has anyone liked that show?
It's, you know, yeah. I mean, I like it, and I think it's okay. I just wish he would whine less about stuff. I don't know. I mean, whining is kind of part of his character, I guess. But I don't know if I like that he wanted to be a spy all of a sudden. Like, it totally dispensed with what the show used to be about, which was him trying to balance his real life with the spy life and having to refute it. And I could see how that would be tiresome after a while, and they would have to, and he'd have to kind of embrace the spy life. And the powers kind of helped him do it. The supernatural aspect of it, I guess, helped him do it. I do kind of like how this week that they kind of made him lose his powers, and they're going to, in normal Chuck fashion, it looks like it's going to be a one off episode where he's going to lose his powers for one week, and then next week is going to be okay. But I don't know. I mean, his power, the him knowing kung fu, the whole Matrix part of that season finale.
No, I don't think that with his powers he's as interesting, because I think that was the entire point of having Casey and Sarah there, was to do all the stuff. Chuck was supposed to stay in the van and then get out of the van and cause trouble and then save the day somehow with his non-powered self. So having the Intersect 2.0 and 3.0 and whichever version we're on now kind of purpose. But I also think, like, this was the first time that a fight between Sarah and Chuck actually worked, which is really bizarre, since none of their fights have ever worked before or been played to whatever pop music Josh Schwartz or Jace was into that day.
the neo-folk music that they're into that, for that week.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one of the things that worked really well was that they actually made the fight happen during an actual fight, which is very nice. Mm-hmm. The literalization of it, I think, really kind of helped sell it. I mean, the entire idea that they need to be fighting bad guys to work through their own issues at the same time gets back to that kind of idea. When I was watching, I was just like, oh, finally, it's a screwball comedy, and all that repressed sexual energy that comes through banter in screwball comedies is coming through this fight with them in the bank and everything, and it's making sense for me. And I was just like, you should be doing more of this. You should be treating Chuck and Sarah as a screwball couple and not as displaced geek and way too hot for him woman. And trying to work that angle more so. Mm-hmm. So they should be a screwball group as opposed to an action duo that mopes a lot.
And what was really cool about that fight, too, is that, I mean, even though they've always had communication problems, Chuck and Sarah have always not been able to tell each other how they feel. There's always been something in the way. They can't tell each other how they feel. They can't tell each other something about something. But they've always been able to work really well fighting and working together. So they're doing the one thing that they do well. They've always been able to have a physical connection. They've always been able to communicate with each other physically, whether that be on a romantic level or at a professional level for them. So for them to have that conversation where they're finally able to communicate while they're having that physical connection is the fight is essentially a metaphor for their an intimacy.
And, right.
For them to have that kind of communication while they're fighting, it's actually pretty cerebral stuff for Chuck, I think.
The other thing that worked really well with that episode was Timothy Dalton. I mean,
get out of here. Yeah, he was great. Brilliant.
I mean, being shy and meek was one thing, and that was really fun to watch Dalton do that, because he's a big guy, and watching him kind of be swallowed up by a cardigan sweater was really cool. But I think the other thing that really benefited from, which none of the other seasons benefited from, is that there's an actual face on the villain, finally. I mean, one of the things I hated about The Ring and Fulcrum was that there was never a face. There was never anything that I could attach myself to and be like, grrr, type of thing with. And now Timothy Dalton as Volkoff has a face, and I like that. And I like that it's Timothy Dalton, too. I think that's the nice thing that they made there, was that we have a villain, not an organization villain, which I think is... And that's one of the reasons I liked Shaw towards the end, was that he was something I could root against. And I really liked that.
Right. I am a little disappointed that Frost wasn't Volkoff, because I kind of wanted Frost to be the bad guy, the big bad.
Well, but Frost does need to be horribly evil, but...
Yeah, it's... Anyway, back to our point, though, about Chuck getting his powers and how that kind of changed the dynamic between him and Casey, or Sarah and Casey a little bit. I think that's where Morgan kind of fits in, is that now that Casey's got Morgan under his wing, and let's face it, let's just put it on the table. Like, that is the reason to watch the show now. Like, Casey, like, who cares? I don't care about Chuck and Sarah anymore. I mean, this last episode kind of demonstrated a little bit of increased interest in them, but for the most part, they've totally gotten on my nerves. I've only been waiting breathlessly for the next scene with Casey and Morgan. And I am all the stuff that they couldn't do with Chuck before because he was too busy whining about his position, they can finally do with Morgan, where he's actually excited about being a spy and he wants to learn. And have this tutelage under somebody that's a little more intense, a little more gruff. And it also helps Casey, you know, leaps and bounds to become a more well-developed character. I think that's the only reason to watch the show anymore is for those two characters. They need to spin them off.
I don't think Chuck is going to get any kind of a spin-off. I think the fact that Chuck has lasted this long is in itself a little miracle.
Oh,
and
it is. There's no way that show is getting a fifth season. No way. If that show gets a fifth season, I'll eat my hat. I'll purchase a hat, and I will eat it.
I do love how often, though, with programming, it's the secondary characters that are so much more interesting and less annoying than the main character.
That's how I feel about Undercovers. The secondary characters, the people that stay in the van, are way cooler than the people that are the spies.
Yep.
I mean that, and I think that's kind of true of J.J. Abrams shows, like spy shows in general. I mean, Alias had good characters, but I was really like, you know, I lived and died by, I can't remember the IT guy's name.
Marshall.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, so since you're on spy shows, let me go ahead and say what I've been thinking about with Nikita, because I know Noel was looking at it this week. And
I caught up, finally.
With all of these spy shows, it is very interesting to try and think about why are we actually there. Chuck is a genre-bending show, so it's got more than just the spy element. But what you guys seem to be saying is that's actually the part that you're less interested in. Nikita, too, is kind of trying to decide what's the balance. And one of the things I'm beginning to really admire about the show is that, unlike Alias, which I loved, Alias always tried to show that she could have her real life and her spy life. And yeah, it was hard to balance, and yeah, sometimes they would overlap and cause trouble, and someone would get kidnapped or what have you. But they still kind of wanted her to be able to have that little area of her world that was not chaotic and that was okay. And that Nikita just threw that out. Like, there are costs to being a spy. There are parts of it that suck. And one of the parts is that you're alone all the time, and that you can't trust anyone, and that you can't be in a relationship. And I kind of love that Nikita's embracing that. They seem to be going in a direction where they're going to try and actually allow the characters to be a little more romantic and whatnot. And as long as that always ends in pain and anguish, I'm okay with it. The reason we have, movies like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, where they're married and they're spies, and that's why it's funny, is because it shouldn't happen. Right. It's not possible. At some point, someone's dead, or something else awful happens. And I kind of want a little darkness in my spy dramas.
Right, and I think, while I was catching up with Nikita, like, last night, which, I just did, like, 4 episodes, all of them back-to-back-to-back last night, was that it's so much better than Burn Notice's right now that I can't get over it. Burn Notice's problem is that it segregates its narrative too much from the client of the week and then whatever crazy arc about the Burn Notice that Michael is still so obsessed with. But Nikita does a very nice job of making sure that the individual story arc for that week, whatever it is, whether it's trying to save some spy or find a black box or something along those lines, it still ties into the larger narrative of trying to take down Division. And on top of that, we get whatever crazy things Alice is doing in the training ground stuff, which is also really fascinating because she's not nearly as competent as Nikita is. So there's actual stakes in what Alice is doing, though we never really doubt that Nikita will be at least middling successful with her plans just because she's so good at her job.
But do you think that people will eventually think that it's too coincidental, everything always tying into this bigger picture? It feels like Burn Notice is kind of afraid of that sometimes. They like to separate their episodic and their serial sometimes because for all of this stuff to be connected every week, all in the same city for however many years this show has been on the air, don't you think people will think that that's way too coincidental?
I don't know, Chuck survived on it for the last 4 years.
Yes, it survived kind of, sort of, in its own weird way it has, but I feel like Burn Notice is afraid of that. It all takes place in Miami. Everything having to do with these seemingly connected organizations and everything he does week by week, all of it tying in together, it just seems too neat and tidy.
Well, I always like a little messiness in my programming, and Nikita has messiness, and it has questions that they haven't answered. Like, they brought them up, though. This is what's funny. They keep bringing them up. How are her missions funded? Where in the world is she getting the money to buy those leather outfits and those evening gowns and all of those guns? No, I know, but the show has asked it twice now. The head of Division asked about it. And then this most recent episode did something which I think is pretty smart. They kind of set up the possibilities for future seasons, kind of avoiding what we were just talking about with Rubicon. Nikita can have a wham-bam finale by taking out the head of Division. And yet, they've already set it up. There's some Russian guys out there that are kind of bad, and there's other
people.
So there's other people that she can chase. I mean, he said to her, when does it end? And of course, it can't end because evil is everywhere and she can always fight them. But, the Russian guy was offering her money and stuff, saying, wouldn't it be much easier for you to do all this if you could be well supplied? She's pretty well supplied. I need to, So Nikita has some issues that they're just choosing not to address, probably in the same way that Bird Notice has just kind of got the blinders on. We're just going to pretend like it's okay that it all happens here. And, you know, that's your suspension of disbelief. Yeah. But I think that the fact that the characters, that it's not easy, the fact that they still struggle, the fact that they still suffer, that's what I'm looking for.
I'm nodding my head right now in agreement.
But yeah, no, so you're liking it? You're going to check it out more or what?
Yeah, I think I'm going to, like, I mean, I really liked the first Guardian episode, but then I just let it fall to the wayside with the guy with the black box and all that. I really liked that episode. And then the next string of episodes were just really, really good. I really hoped that she was going to keep the little dog from the Russian interns.
I was hoping she was going to keep the guy with the black box. I mean, it was, even though I want her to be a spy and for them to show us that that's a hard life, you also do kind of want her to have some banter. You know, you do want her to be able to have someone to play off of and whatever. And I think the show's aware of it. So I think, you know, we'll see. If the CW makes it too soapy, I'll probably be a little disappointed. But bringing in different characters and giving her different people to, you know, to interact with is not a bad thing. And the other fun thing is that they introduce some characters, they put them through the ringer, and then the characters kind of go off somewhere. And I have every expectation to see them again. And that's kind of fun, too.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I mean, we'll see that. We'll see the guy that she, like, patched up again, no doubt.
Yeah, definitely.
And we'll see the guy that went through the killing spree in the division headquarters, and I think that's great as well. And, I mean, I really thought he was going to turn into an ally for Alex in there, and no, he's going to be probably Alex's main nemesis.
Yeah, so there's a lot of potential here. I think they'll, you know, maybe take down Division, and we'll see kind of, I think it, you know, helps for Nikita to be somewhat isolated. But I think that they're putting some things in place already, pretty early, to give this show some longevity. And even though it's still popcorn and CW and all that, lots of hot people wearing hot clothes, like I said, it's not Alias. It's nowhere near the depth of emotion that that show is able to reach. But I think there are things about it that I can admire right now. So,
well, with that in mind, I mean, let's talk about the CW a bit, because, I mean, all of you watch a lot of the CW.
Yep.
I only watch Nikita. I mean, so, talk about the CW a little bit. I mean, I'm not super familiar with the CW as a whole, but, I mean, how does its brand work? How do the shows work to contribute to that? Because I don't think of the Nikita as a CW show, in my brain, anyway.
Really?
Well, Karen just gave you what the CW is all about. It's hot people and hot clothes. That is the brand for, that's the brand for the network.
Which is why they decided to dress Lux up like a slut for the last couple of weeks.
Oh, that's the other show. You know, it didn't annoy me as much as Parenthood, but oh, Lord, Life Unexpected.
Yeah, talk about Life Unexpected. Let's talk about Life Unexpected.
Wow.
Can we come back to Parenthood later? I have to say, I really want to defend this show now. But we'll come back to it. Talk about Life Unexpected.
Life Unexpected started off being a nice little family drama that was supposed to fill the void that actually Parenthood probably filled in better. But,
yes.
And then all of a sudden, the second season rolled around, and I think somebody told them that they need to fit the CW brand a little bit better, so they decided that they're going to slut up Lux a little bit. And they even called, what did they call her, Sluxy, one week, because she was dressed up so slutty that they called her Sluxy. And the transformation of the show over the last, especially the last couple of weeks, especially with the student-teacher relationship that's going on, that's completely disgusting.
Ugh, yeah.
It's so gross. It's so
why in the world would they choose to take the show in that direction? I just cannot even fathom.
The only other thing I can think of is that they thought that the show didn't have as much edge as all the other shows on the network do. I mean, Gossip Girl's got a little more edge. Gossip Girl, which I watched the first time last week.
Ooh, good episode.
Yeah, and well, it was the episode where Blair, I think Blair, is that her name?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She has a party. In Madeline Albright.
So you saw 2 weeks ago, and I actually
haven't seen it yet,
because my DVR chose not to tape it, and the CW doesn't let their shows air for 3 full days streaming, so I have not gotten to watch it yet, thank you, CW.
But Life Unexpected, I think somebody told them at the beginning of the season, like, you gotta match the hot people, hot, edgy kind of feel that the rest of the network has. You know, except for Smallville. And
hey, okay, well, continue.
Is Smallville slutty? I didn't know.
Yes, have you? Every episode seems to place Erica Durance in some new type of fetish costume.
Oh, fair enough.
This year she's dressed up like Isis, a dominatrix, a very, like, female Indiana Jones outfit. She is in something different all the time. She is the sex appeal of that show. They try and play her up. And I mean, she's gorgeous, yes, but I mean, that's where that comes from. And Tom Welling, you know, I mean, I guess women still find him attractive, even though he's like 40 now. But there is still a lot of sex appeal to Smallville. It's just not as blatant as Gossip Girl and Life Unexpected
Now.
Well,
Life Unexpected Now, I guess. Yeah, I mean, that proves the point more. It's like, you know, all these other shows that are on the network are kind of, they kind of play into that role. And then Life Unexpected, that this quirky little family drama, all of a sudden now they've got to make the only, apparently they thought that the only woman on the show that they could make, you know, appealing, quote unquote, I'm making air quotes, you can't see it. But the only woman that they can make appealing is the 16-year-old, and they decided to put her in stoop necks all of the entire show, and decided that she needs to dive into a lake with her teacher in her underpants. Which,
but here's what I have to say. I mean, poor Sherry Appleby, because I am old, so I watched her on Roswell.
Oh, yeah, Roswell was great.
And watching, you know, seeing her come back as a mother of a 16-year-old was really devastating to me, since that means I'm older than I want to be. But that said, I mean, Roswell 2 was a show that kind of came out and, you know, it just wasn't getting the numbers they wanted. And so when that happens and they decide to keep a show, sometimes they can just get out of the way. You know, the reason the DirecTV Friday Night Lights thing is such a miracle is because they didn't try to futz with the show. They just kind of said, we're going to support it, give you 2 years, do it the way you need to, and then you're done. And so the show hasn't had to do some of the craziness they had tried to do in their season 2. But with Life Unexpected, you're right. They definitely, there was some executive, you know, pressure and futzing with the show that has taken it completely away from what it was in season 1. And so it's amazing how when a show doesn't quite hit they want it the way they want it to, they throw away all of the stuff that people actually did like. So that even those that were there suddenly don't like it anymore.
Is that true with Supernatural too?
What? That they futz with the show?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't watch Supernatural, I mean, so I can't really say, but I mean...
No, Supernatural is a different kind of thing. I kind of wrote a whole paper about this recently, but Supernatural, I kind of was trying to say it's a show that amazingly has survived with its integrity intact, despite these various things, and the Supernatural, number one, is a WB show, and it's not just that it came from the WB network. But you know, so it has that kind of pedigree, but also it is produced by Warner Brothers. So their stake in that show, I think, protects it a little bit from some of this. Mm-hmm. I haven't looked at who makes Life Unexpected. It's always an interesting question with these kinds of shows to see, who's working so hard for it, who's trying to keep it. I think Supernatural, the thing with Supernatural is it's always been the second show. It's always been the show that's paired with something else. And it has usually been consistent about holding on to most of the audience. It's done very well with Smallville. And so its expectations are different because they're not expecting it to be the main show of the evening. It's always just doing cleanup. And it's always done reasonably well with that. My guess is Life Unexpected has not been batting cleanup well.
I mean, it's been after...
What's the CBS, by the way?
It's by who?
CBS.
Oh, there's CBS banned my existence. So,
well, CBS, is, I mean, they're half owners of the CW, too. But it's another thing, this is its own thing worthy of study, is to take a look at the shows that CBS produces versus Warner Brothers and actually see if the futzing is different. Because you might find that, I mean, it seems to me that the shows that are Warner Brothers produced actually are given kind of a long leash. That might not be always true, but it's just because of this conversation, it's something I might want to look at in the future. But no, I think Supernatural has always been very simple. It's always kept a really tight focus. There have been some stunts along the way, certainly. There have been some moves that the fans haven't liked. There was a character they all hated, and so they just recast her at one point. But it's always been very clear that those brothers are the heart of the show, their relationship, and the car. And everything else has just been the dressing on the side. Life Unexpected, they did not understand that it's not really about Lux. It's actually about how she's interacting with these two grown-up babies.
Right.
And the minute the focus left that and became about Lux off in her own universe with nobody paying any attention to her,
right,
that ruins the show.
Essentially, Lux being a jackass. It did kind of ruin the show.
All of those characters are super unlikable. Like, even Ryan, who was like the rock and was like the most reliable, nice guy ever, suddenly they create all this drama for him. I mean... I just have no interest in watching characters be pathetic also.
That, and you, to that point, like Ryan in season one definitely was that rock. And they, I mean, the last episode of last season where during the wedding, they had a great emotional moment where, you know, he kind of felt like he didn't belong and he was always mm-hmm. left on the outside. And he told Lux, he had a conversation with Lux. He was like, Lux, I, if you feel like that your parents need, basically, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but basically if you feel like your parents need to be together, you need to talk to, talk to her about it. And,
yeah.
And then, so they had this great moment and, they got married, Kate and Ryan got married anyway or whatever. And then they totally ruined the whole thing within the first few episodes of the second season by saying that emotional moment was actually caused by him sleeping with his ex-girlfriend and possibly getting her pregnant.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. The wedding episode was actually pretty strong. And season two has just, it's like it's an entirely new team of writers who are 15 years younger than the writers before, who clearly have never done this before. And so they're just going for wherever the flashing light is. They're just following it. And the flashing light apparently is easy sex and betrayal and people acting completely opposite of their characters. And yeah, it's a huge disappointment. And it happens with shows that struggle their first season. And you have to decide, are you happy it at least got a second run, or do you wish they would have just put it out of its misery?
Which is a terrible thing to have to choose between, is whether you want them to maybe give them a chance to kind of get back on track, or if you would like to just let the story die.
For me, the ghost of ghost haunting Life Unexpected is Everwood, and it's kind of, it's the question of, can the CW do a show like that? I'm not sure it's actually appropriate for the CW. I think the brand is so much dominated by Gossip Girl and that kind of the shows of that ilk, that when they try to do something that is more family-centered and maybe even just a little more mainstream, perhaps, even though there's still youth at the focus, I don't think they do it well.
No, it's almost like those kind of shows, even though that's kind of how the grandfathers of this network kind of made their name. I mean, that's how the WB made its name, was from that family kind of centered drama. I mean, Everwood, Gilmore Girls, Dawson's Creek, all those kind of shows.
Seventh Heaven.
And Buffy.
Oh, God, Seventh Heaven. So, I mean, that's how they made the brand. Now it's kind of the show's an anachronism within that network. I mean, it just doesn't belong. It seems like it's just out of place.
Lux, this first season of Life Unexpected was a last-ditch effort at that kind of programming, and it's just proven that it cannot fit on this network anymore. There's no room for something like that. It needed to go elsewhere if it was going to be able to survive. And
I agree.
It's just, looking at the transition between the first season and the second season, just goes to show you exactly what the CW is all about.
Yeah. And you know what? It's not that what the CW does is a bad thing.
No, not at all.
I am watching Wildcats. I put a post up this week about it. I'm still in there, even though it's one of those shows where the main character is the most annoying character on the show. But, that's young girls wearing those darn cheerleader outfits all the time. I swear they wear it to the grocery store. It's very bizarre. But, they still are able, they have some adults on that show that so far are still acting like adults, shockingly. They have some strong friendships developing where characters are actually trying to do the right thing. So, I mean, even within their little niche, they can still do good programming. It's just a programming of a particular type. But yes, they do not seem to be able to, handle and support family-based shows and attract that audience. There is some responsibility they have to take for being unable to get the audience that Parenthood is trying to attract. How do you market those to those people? And I don't think the CW knows how to do that.
And I don't even really think they care. Look at their marketing now. Their whole big thing right now is TV to text, blog, chat about. And it's like older people don't even know what half of those words mean. And so they're not, I don't even think they care about that kind of an audience anymore.
Right, so you wonder why they're doing a show like Life Unexpected. I mean, somebody there cares. And I think the CW is not above wanting to be known for some quality. They send their shows up for Emmys or Peabody's, or actually, I don't know if they've done the Peabody's, so that would be a riot to go look at. But they did a whole ad series for shows that they should be considered for Emmys one season. So, I mean, I think I don't think any network necessarily wants to throw away the possibility of quality. But I don't think they're understanding how to achieve quality within their niche. That's the stronger way for them right now.
It seems like even though the CW tried their best with Life Unexpected and tried to do a family drama, seems like the NBC did Parenthood better anyway. You want to have your 60 seconds to defend Parenthood real quick, Matt?
I do, and it's not even really that big of a defense, because at its core, to me, Parenthood is just a show. For the most part, it's a showcase for some of these amazing veteran actors that we all love. It's a very simple show about the different kinds of families that there are today. They're touching on stuff about kids with disorders and interracial relationships and, you know, a lot of really current, relevant family stuff. And it's just a nice look into these characters' lives every week. That's really all it is for me. It's a nice hour of heartwarming, sometimes heartbreaking television.
I've tried it a couple of times. What is it up against? Noel, is it up against The Good Wife? Is that what it's...
Yeah, Tuesdays okay. at 10, right?
Right, yeah, so I'm always going to go with The Good Wife. Yeah. So Parenthood's just something it doesn't fit into what I watch with my husband, and it doesn't fit my DVR schedule. So it's... I would certainly consider watching it more, but it's not really my niche. That kind of heartwarming. It doesn't seem like if I actually describe for you all of the programming I'm watching, you see nothing like Parenthood on there. So I guess I'm not their target audience.
I'm not The Good Wife's target audience. That's not stopping me.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm nowhere near... It's weird, those shows that we find, because I would say I'm probably one of the farthest things from Gossip Girl's target audience, and yet it's one of my favorite shows to watch. So it's interesting, those shows that we all have, that we are nowhere near its, you know, demographic, and yet we rave about it.
Well, I mean, if we look at that list that came out this week, I mean, clearly Matt shouldn't be watching The Big Bang Theory because he's not a Republican.
I didn't look at that list yet. I need to, huh? It's funny.
Oh, it's hilarious.
It's something.
I want to talk about real quick the big story for this week is Conan came back on Monday. So have you guys watched Conan yet?
Yes.
I watched an episode and a half.
What did you guys think?
He did the Late Show with Conan O'Brien, which I'm perfectly okay with, and I don't quite understand why everyone was so disappointed with the fact that he did that show, because that's the show that he wants to do. It's what he's always wanted to do. And I don't know quite what people were expecting. They just weren't expecting that, I think. And I think that really frustrated a lot of people. I was perfectly okay with it, because
yeah,
I was just happy to have that lanky, red-headed Irishman back on television again.
Maybe it's that basic cable effect we keep talking about. We're looking to cable to create everything new and wondrous. And therefore, Conan also needed to be vigorous, instead of just network TV on basic cable.
Right. I mean, I think that's one thing that he drove home a little too hard, was the fact that he was on TBS and no one knows what TBS is, and the basic cable is this ghetto. But if it's such a ghetto, why are you there, Conan? If it's so horrible, why are you there? You're relishing the fact that you're back on TV again, and TBS gave you that opportunity, regardless of whether or not the fact that it's owned by Tyler Perry at this point.
don't knock on Tyler Perry, other than for Colored Girls. He's been doing just fine. I'm not going to continue, most likely, with Conan, just because I guess I don't really do talk shows either. It's just not something I'm into. Watching stars go on and on about their little life is not terribly interesting to me, and these shows are built up to be publicity machines.
I mean, most of the time, whenever I watch like a late night show, I normally only do the monologue and then I go to something else, because like you, I'm not particularly interested in what the celebrities are saying. So I think that's what will end up happening, is that if I'm in the mood for Conan and I don't want to watch The Daily Show for whatever reason, I just don't.
What reason could that possibly be? I mean, this is the real issue, isn't it, Noel? That it's up against The Daily Show and Colbert, and why in the world would I ever choose Conan over those two? I can't think of a single reason.
John's in reruns?
There you go. All right. Good point. Thank you. You came up with the one reason. Although that new girl on Colbert is making me kind of want to run and kill myself. So.
What about Matt and Nick? What did you guys think?
It was okay. I mean, I got what I expected out of it. And I've never... I like Conan. I do. But I've never understood the rabid, obsessive fan base he has. And I think that's where some of the disappointment came from. And so I have to admit, I kind of smirked at, what was it, like that 32% drop from Monday to Tuesday, because all of these people are so obsessed and Conan's the best thing to ever happen to television. And then his show was just kind of like, it was mediocre. And now everyone's kind of dropping out of it. And I agree. I'm not going to watch it all the time. If there's someone, you know, that I particularly, like, really love, I might check it out. But I'd rather catch up on stuff.
Which is the same
reason
why you would catch a talk show anyway now. Is if there's somebody that you really love that's on, like, you know, I catch interviews with Lauren Graham. Even though Lauren Graham kind of annoys me in interviews, I still catch her every time she's on.
Mm-hmm. Right. You'll still just watch. Because I don't, like, do people just consistently watch talk shows all the time? Like, that seems so weird to me that someone will just watch Letterman every night, every week. That I don't get it.
I would consider watching Craig Ferguson.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
yeah. He's different though. He's kind of a genre bender in that way. He's done shows where he's kicked the audience out just so that he can talk to somebody. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, he's kind of fascinating. I think, you know, what has been the role of late night historically, right? It's kind of doing what Colbert does better and what Stewart does better. It's what's the latest news? How are we going to laugh at the politicians? What's the exciting stuff that's happening in entertainment?
Right. It's almost like the current talk show hosts kind of take what Carson did so well, which was that interaction with everybody kind of making you feel like that you're part of the conversation. And they're kind of like poor imitations of that kind of aesthetic. Like going to sleep before or after the monologue. I mean, that's the only reason that anybody don't want to watch the show anymore, because everything else is them trying to copy or imitate what Carson did so well in his time. And I hope that everybody knows I'm not talking about Carson Daly.
Yeah. You know, there's an argument that late night has been killed by the web.
By the web?
Yeah, because everything is so immediate now that you don't need Carson to tell you what happened today or what was the news. Because right. You see it all online and the jokes have already been made. And heck, with these monologues, you know, Conan's monologue was online before he ever uttered it for the first episode.
That was public relations.
So the internet's kind of, you know, killed the whole thing. It no longer can do the topical thing as well as it used to be able to. So I think that's part of the issue too with maybe some of the disappointment is that people are aware that late night might be dying as a genre, even though the ratings don't fully reflect, you know, it at the, you know, death knell or whatever, that we're not sure what its function is anymore.
I can see that. I can see that the web kind of eliminates kind of the topical monologue jokes. And then the other part of it, which is where you're supposed to kind of feel like the celebrities are in your living room. I mean, kind of Twitter takes care of that now, too, because yep. I mean, Twitter kind of builds that your relationship with celebrities better than any other medium has right now. So it's kind of like, yeah, I can see how the internet has kind of destroyed what talk shows do best. And, I mean, all that's left for Conan outside of those things are live musical performances, which you can catch later, or the skits that they do, and trying to see those first. And their skits haven't been very strong since Late Night ended, and I would say even months before Late Night ended. So, I mean, what is there left for talk shows if the main parts of them are being serviced elsewhere?
And I guess that's why people were maybe thinking Conan would show us a little bit of the future.
And that's because he built his brand, that brand so well. Like, once he got kicked out, that very public kind of, you know, losing his job, which is how he makes that now. But he built that brand so well over the last few months with the tour and with the, you know, the Twitter account and making and doing, you know, new things. I mean, that whole thing where he followed one person and then got everybody to kind of pay for a wedding and kind of do all kinds of great stuff for that one person. I mean, that's kind of an original way of not yeah. using that technology, but also communicating with an audience. And so you
felt like... And why wasn't she on this week? That was my thing. I was just like, where is she?
I was curious of that, too. I thought that she was going to be the first guest, like the first secret guest. But, he did so many kind of rule-breaking things over the last few months leading up to the cable show. You thought, well, this, I mean, they thought the same thing with Leno when he was going to come at 10 o'clock, that he was going to break genre a little bit and try to do something brand new, and he didn't do anything because he's, you know, decrepit. But Conan, you kind of expected, because he did all those great things over the last few months, that he was going to come out and do something that kind of wrecked the mold a little bit, and he came out and did the show that he's always wanted to do, which was the show that he did at 12:35.
Mm.
I do know one guest that will make Karen watch Conan instead of The Daily Show, though.
Who is that?
Fareed.
Well, this is true. Yeah, I'll follow him anywhere. He got me to watch Bill Maher, and I hate Bill Maher. Like, really deeply hate him. So, and I was displeased by how Bill Maher and those other guests talked all over my Fareed. So, I have a special passion for Fareed Zakaria, formerly of Newsweek, now of Time. So, I go where he goes. It's true.
Newsweek, The Daily Beast.
Even The Talk. If Fareed showed up on The Talk, I would tape that. And I watched The Talk once and we'll never go back.
That's a hit for the team. Wow. Time that we could end the conversation here.
Hey, you might want to break this down into some little segments.
Fair enough. And thanks, guys, for listening. Hopefully you enjoyed it. We'll try to do this once a week. And if anybody else have anything to tag on at the end?
No, thanks for reading.
Yeah, indeed. We actually, I'll say this, we had our best week this past week. So thanks to all of you for reading. It's been really good for us, and we really appreciate the visit.
Nope.
Huh?
Matt's got nothing. I got nothing.
All right, guys.
See y'all later.
Talking next week.
Bye.
I'm waving.